Hello everybody, it's George from Ireland. Thanks for coming back to my channel. Just finishing off the videos doing yesterday, got cut off partway through. This is about Simon Mann. Only found out about his death yesterday, who has been called to the great big battlefield in the sky at the age of 72 of natural causes. And that's perhaps the most astonishing thing, considering the harum scarum life he led in seeking battles all over the world. A guy who seemingly crossed the street to have a fight, always putting himself in harm's way. So he's born in 1952, and his father had been captain of the English cricket team, a guards officer in the Second World War. His grandfather had also captained the English cricket side, the only father and son pair to captain England's cricket 11. But Mann, as he said, was no good at cricket, and he was a wet bobbers and a rower. So where he went to Eton, where he wasn't that academic. In the 60s, not that difficult to get in. Anthony Chenoweth Trench then came along, really raised the academic standards, because prior to that time, unless if your father went there, you're virtually guaranteed to get in, so long as you could pay the fees. So you needed two A levels to go into Sandhurst. That's where you trained to be an army officer. Would he get it? Well, that was touch and go, but he did in the end. And I've seen lots of interviews with Simon Mann, and he's saying, oh, in the 60s at Eton, you could be whatever you want, you could be gay. Well, I think that was very much disapproved of. I think people dabbled in it, but as soon as they left school, the great majority of them grew out of it. Remember, homosexual acts between males were illegal until 1967 in England and Wales. So, yeah, another thing I should point out is Mann's mother was South African. When his father was on a cricket team of South Africa just after the Second World War, that's where he met Simon Mann's mother and they got married. Anyway, they were heirs to the Watney Mann brewing fortune. It was founded in 1809, but by the time Mann was growing up, that fortune was whittled away. They weren't that wealthy, but they did live on Chester Square in Chelsea. Now that is a very she address. That would cost several million quid at least these days. And there's a blue plaque on it. It's the one where Matthew Arnold lived, the celebrated 19th century poet. Wow. So and anyway, well, he went on to the Royal Military Academy and he won the Soviet Studies Prize, which must have included a bit of the Russian language. So he wasn't that much of a slouch intellectually. But you've got to remember, when he left school in 1970, a very small percentage of people went on to university, about 7%, as opposed to almost 50% these days. And 1972 is commissioned to the Scots Guards, that socially elite regiment of the British Army, as in the officers tend to be very upper class, have a private income. Even in the 90s, people said you needed a private income. Sent to Northern Ireland, where the Ulster conflict was raging. And so the officers tend to be out of the top drawer, like himself, whereas the guardsmen, they tend to be from very working class or even underclass families. Not meaning to be disrespectful, but underclass is a very difficult family situation. You know, dad's in jail, mum is mentally ill, one of the parents is a drug addict or whatever, one of the parents beat up the other. Things like that. Never met your father, been in whatever, a Young Offenders Institute for being a juvenile delinquent. Now, some of them came from happy working class families and didn't have those difficulties, but the army is often a family for those who didn't have a family. Anyway, he got out of Northern Ireland. One of the things impressive about Simon Mann, he was completely unfazed by everything, and he was totally self-effacing, was never blowing his own trumpet, and just took it in his stride. All these hair-raising incidents. So, and then he served at various other places like Cyprus, was it Belize, West Germany. Remember, the British Army, the Rhine was going till about 10 years ago. Anyway, he left the army in the mid 1980s, and he worked in the security field. That was very shady, wouldn't tell people what he was really doing, partly providing bodyguards for rich Arabs in London. And then 1991, he's recalled to the colours compulsorily for the Gulf War, the liberation of Kuwait. But with Sir Peter de la Billiere, the British commander in Riyadh, I mean, he had to organize things from behind the lines, not actually go into combat. And in the early 90s, he got involved in the Angolan Civil War. He was actually commissioned as a general in the Angolan army. He got into that via being an oil executive, and that's because Angola got quite a lot of oil, and the most useful thing he could do with his military background was to help defeat UNITA at the FNLA, so fighting for the MPLA, who were erstwhile communists. But anyway, they won. I do remember him writing, "Don't get captured. Whatever happens in this conflict, do not get captured, because the treatment meted out to you will make you wish you were dead." Well, he didn't get captured, and then he was involved with Tony Buckingham and otherwise others. He met a lot of former apartheid-era South African soldiers. They were involved in various mercenary outfits or private military companies, is the alias used these days in the 90s. And then he was a friend of Sir Mark Thatcher, the son of Margaret Thatcher, who was living in Cape Town at that time, socializing with Lord Spencer's and Princess Diana's younger brother. But fast forward, cut to the chase, is the Wonga coup 2004. So trying to overthrow President Obiang, I haven't pronounced it correctly, in the Equatorial Guinea, the only former Spanish colony in sub-Saharan Africa, a tiny country but oil rich. Most people live in penury because the president and his cronies cream it all off. So a plot was hatched. Mark Thatcher agreed to at least a helicopter to help the coup. There are about 85 men, experienced mercenaries, former South African British Army guys. And from his experience in Northern Ireland, Mann said the weapons and the men going to use them come together at the last possible moment for the last possible time. If you're ever arrested, the most convincing evidence against you will be the illegal weapon, so don't have it. And also, after the weapon is fired in Northern Ireland, the IRA man runs that way, someone with a gun runs that way to hide it, and so to try and make sure they're not caught red-handed. Anyhow, so Nick Dutoit, a SAFER, flew into Equatorial Guinea with 14 men posing as tourists. The rest, Simon Mann, and the weapons are coming via Harare, Zimbabwe, but he's arrested at Harare, severely beaten up, and so on. He said that the torture wasn't even that bad. I mean, how could he say there wasn't actual torture? Just being kicked and punched and stuff like that, and being in a filthy cell, not being able to change his clothes, not adequate laboratorial facilities, and saying to the interrogators, "Okay, will you please just lay off the beatings? We'll tell you everything. No need to beat us up. We'll squeal." And indeed, they did. And he said, when he was questioned, clearly they knew the whole plan, but they were just verifying that he confirmed everything. They wanted to see that he told them every scrap of information. At various times, he thought he was about to be shot dead. And I don't know how he kept his spirits up. His resilience was really just extraordinary. He's filmed sometimes in his prison uniform, chained to his doppelganger, going in and out of court, and just received seemed remarkably upbeat, nonchalant, and humorous about it. So I don't know how he found these, reserves of strength. Bear in mind, he was onto his a third wife by this point. I think his seventh child was born while he was in prison. He didn't see that little boy till the boy was about five. And there he was, eating in Zimbabwe. Some of the prisoners were dying of malnutrition. Others were agreeing to have gay sex just to get extra rations, and then dying of AIDS. I mean, it was just an unbelievably grim situation. Was he going to be extradited to Equatorial Guinea, where he's going to face the death penalty? There are also some legal challenges to that. Eventually, Judge Patel of the Zimbabwean Supreme Court gives the go-ahead to that, and then he goes. Now, I've read Cry Havoc, which is his book about it. Taken from that line in Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, "Cry havoc and let's let the dogs of war," is also allusion to Frederick Forsyth's classic novel from the 1970s about a coup in a fictitious African country, which is called the Dogs of War, because it's from the same line of that play. He's not very literary, but he had a different style. It's almost text message speech, not bothering with full sentences. It's got pace. It's very unique. It is his voice. He's not at all fake. That's one of the things that I admire about him. Eventually, he was sent to Equatorial Guinea. He says illegally. It was even against Zimbabwean law. There is the notorious Black Sands prison. Anyway, held in fairly humane conditions, and he told them everything he knew. And they said, "Well, who is the mole?" There was clearly someone inside the regime giving information, and he, or maybe even she, was hoping to profit from this coup d'état and have a major role in the new setup. He said, "I don't know. I honestly don't know. I tell you, if I do, it's his life or mine. I don't know." And eventually, they believed him. And by the way, who financed all this? In his famous first letter out of that Zimbabwean prison, he mentioned Scratcher, an allusion to Thatcher, Mark Thatcher, and Smelly rhymes with Ellie, as in Ellie Khalil, this Lebanese British businessman who was very rather reclusive. There's only one photo of Ellie Khalil ever published, and that's from a wedding in the 1970s. So Khalil avoided the limelight. He made a fortune, I think, in Nigeria in the 70s. And he died, I think, from falling down the stairs at home in 2018. And eventually, Simon Mann was willing to say, yeah, it was Ellie Khalil and Mark Thatcher and so on. He didn't blame them for saying nothing. Thatcher got a slap on the wrist sentence in South Africa when he admitted to a small part in the coup, and was therefore deported as an alien criminal. I couldn't even live in the United States because of that. He's married to a Texan, was at the time. So what else about Good old Simon Mann, or bad old Simon Mann. So hilarious. He was filmed on by Channel 4 being interviewed in his prison, saying how conditions in Equatorial Guinea were much better than he led to believe. And with the Minister of Justice there watching him whilst he was saying it, so bad dare not badmouth them. But he was released after only 5 years. That was a really good result. He said that coup would either make him a millionaire or get him killed. Well, he's wrong on both counts. So in a way, he got off lightly. And how did he manage to be so upbeat? Because you think you're either going to be executed or spend the rest of your life in a horrific prison. And his spirits never flagged. Wow, so he got home. I saw him in Waterloo Station about 3 years ago, just outside it, cycling a Boris bike. I didn't call out to him. I wrote to him after I'd read his book, Cry Havoc, but he never wrote back, wanting to interview him. I suppose he wants lots of money for interviews, and he's interviewed by loads of people. And he might be faintly suspicious because he's pissed off a lot of powerful people. So that is Simon Mann. They don't make him like that anymore. Was he a buccaneer? Did he buckle some squash? We've got to remember he was a gun for hire. He was willing to do things which were at very least illegal, quite probably immoral. In that coup d'etat, people were certainly going to get killed, even if it's just one or two soldiers. But Equatorial Guinean soldiers who are defending their country, doing nothing wrong, some of them were going to get killed. Now, Mann claimed the Spanish government was saying, yeah, go ahead. But it's got no documentary evidence of this because obviously they don't want any provable evidence they did that. Plausible deniability. The United States was flashing green behind it. The United Kingdom wanted to go ahead, blah, 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 but they couldn't commit anything to writing. Now, is that true? I don't know. But if it's not true, why would he write it? It makes the book more saleable. Is it also a way of embarrassing governments he thought didn't help him out enough when he was in prison? Or was he duped? Was he led to believe it was true by people who thought if we convince him of this, then he's more likely to go ahead with it? Thinking it's got backing of these other countries. Right, Spain being the former colonial metropole there. Hilarious anecdotes about having lunch with the Minister of Justice and was the president whilst handcuffed in the prison, and he's having wine and the prison's right beside the presidential palace and blah blah blah. That is Simon Mann. Wow. He doesn't seem as hard as nails, but he definitely was. I mean, I knew a woman who'd met him at Lambeth Halebury, where his children were at prep school, and said he was a super nice man. Well, that's it. That is the end of an era, I suppose, with someone like Simon Mann called to his reward. Goodbye.